Welcome to Double Take, critical, sometimes confrontational conversations about movies. Double Take is a Cinema Classics production hosted by myself, Johnny DiLoretto, and John DeSando.
I'm John DeSando.
I already said who I was.
Well, let's do it.
We know this is Double Take.
And let's do a double take on two classic movies.
Okay.
See what we can mash up here.
Because there are two books out, right?
Yeah.
Now. One is Sam Wasson's The Big Goodbye.
Yep.
And the other is Made Men by Glenn Kenny. The former examines the making of and the history behind the amazing, legendary Chinatown, and the other one celebrates a 30th anniversary in the making of Scorsese's Goodfellas.
Oh my gosh.
So we got our hands full.
Yes, you're right. I think the two of us, you could probably say Goodfellas ranks at the very top of the movies in
for Europe. Sure.
And for me, Chinatown has almost everything that a movie could be.
Yeah. Let's start with Chinatown because they're so drastically different movies stylistically.
Yeah, that's right.
And in the way they're paced. And the stories they're telling, but maybe there's some connections we can uncover.
Yeah, and you know, in Chinatown, I see a team making a great film here. In Goodfellas, I see a director directing premier actors.
Yeah.
So I see a little bit of a difference, I think, with what you were alluding to.
That's interesting. That's what a lot of the book, Wasson's book, gets into, is this, the collaborative nature, right?
Yeah.
That you just don't arrive at a movie like this.
No.
But he also does a wonderful job painting a picture of that era of Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
which I think the book laments the passing of.
Sure.
You know, you have producers like Robert Evans who aren't just interested in turning a profit. They actually want to leave something lasting behind. So they bring together extraordinary talent. They care about it. They care for it. They get the creative team together and they massage it. They work out the kinks. Robert Towne's script, often considered the greatest screenplay ever written. But here you learn that really Polanski should be given credit for really shaping that.
Oh, and
that unwieldy story.
And you know how much I love the ending, and that's Polanski's ending to that movie, which is a downbeat ending, counterintuitive.
Right. Don't you think you'd always make downbeat endings to if your pregnant wife hadn't been murdered by the Mansons?
And you had escaped the Nazis?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think.
Mean, wow. That's the other thing. I thought that there was going to be a lot of heavy sort of examination of how Polanski's experience shaped that movie, but it doesn't. It's, you know, it's there for us to sort of tease out.
Because, you've got so many big egos and talents there. You got Jack Nicholson alone. He's not just an actor.
No.
Jack is a force.
And that's the other thing that we get a deeper understanding of is Nicholson's, you know, fame came to him a little bit late and is a little bit of a surprise. Nicholson toiled for years in smaller Roger Corman movies. He was learning the craft. He could direct, by the way. You know, he directed a couple of movies too early on in his career. But what I think you loved about learning about this phase in Nicholson's career is how loyal he was to his friends.
Oh, yes.
How he kept that creative cadre around him, you know, people like Towne, Bob Rafelson, Robert Evans.
Yeah. And I think in the case of Evans and others, that Jack was influential. And for Polanski, I think he was a major part of the creation of this film. He wasn't just a great actor.
Yeah.
He was also culturally a force inside them.
Yeah, and he had this desire to do good work. That's the other thing that comes through is he wanted to, you know, make a lasting sort of contribution to American culture, and this was the way he was going to do it, was through cinema. The other thing that I love about this book, and I think as casual moviegoers, we often take for granted, like you said, the collaborative nature. We don't think about how other people, the lesser known people on the sidelines, are actually contributing to these pieces of work. So, for instance, I was fascinated by how Dick Silbert, the production designer, and his wife Sylvia, the costume designer, how they collaborated. First of all, they were trying to help Polanski and Towne realize their vision. But they had strategies, aesthetic strategies And you know, like there was never going to be white above an eye line, like, you know, because they wanted people to be looking up into like empty space.
Yes.
And stuff like that. I love that.
And the actual tone of the film, which is memorable. There's a crispness about it, but there's not a bleeding color idea about it. It's
right.
Very sharp.
And it's very deliberate.
Yes.
And that was a great anecdote in the book, is that they sat down for the cut, for the, you know, the final cut.
Yes.
And they had processed the film in a way to make it look brighter, I think.
Yes, yes.
And Nicholson was furious.
Yeah.
And he said immediately, he was like, "You will take this out. You'll put it back the way it was, or I won't do any press for this movie. I'll disown it." And you know, and then because of that commitment to quality, because of that commitment to the artistic vision.
Yes.
You know, and this is what I, you know, I was just a 4 or 5 years old at the time. I'm always fascinated by, so I love books like this. I'm always fascinated by this period in American history,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
where mainstream audiences widespread across the country responded to movies like this. Like, we don't see that anymore. You know, we've effectively kind of created this little circle, this little offshoot of cinema that we now call independent cinema, where stories like this get told. But what was going on?
Well, think about that monster coming over the hill, TV.
Mm-hmm.
And then look at what comes later, which would be Jaws, E.T., whatever, comes after this. It's a different kind of film. You're talking exactly about an art period for film.
Right. And Pauline Kael said, you know, what was great about cinema at that time was that cinema was dealing with these things that television wasn't.
Yes.
You could, during the late 60s and 70s, you went to TV, you were getting the stuff, the themes and the kind of story points and the techniques that they used in 40s and 50s cinema, like, you know, on a daily basis.
Sure.
So you weren't getting anything interesting in television there. Movies, that's where you went to the, that's why you went,
yes,
to the movies.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
To explore the human condition. Wasson says that what happened really is after a couple of financial disasters, you know, they just saw money. And
sure,
they brought in TV executives,
yep,
to run Hollywood.
Right.
So guys like Robert Evans get shoved aside, and they just start going after the big dollars.
Certainly, the very influential producers in Hollywood were not like Robert Evans at all coming into this period, this TV period. Evans was a glamour boy. He had been an actor. And he understood movies, and he was vain and self-centered.
Yeah, but
brilliant.
That description of him makes him sound like he would have been a nightmare to work with.
Of course.
But he did have something. Maybe that's where he saw his strengths and his ability,
yes,
to contribute to the art. Right.
Without a doubt.
Was in bringing these people together, and helping them realize what they were trying to accomplish with a movie like Chinatown.
Yeah.
Now. So what happens is, first of all, you're listening to Double Take, critical, sometimes confrontational conversations about movies. Double Take is a Cinema Classics production hosted by Johnny DiLoretto and John DeSando.
Yeah, boy. So here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Make that transition for me. Going from 74 to what would it be, 90?
Mm-hmm.
For Goodfellas?
Mm-hmm.
Can you see the difference between the two?
So I can, but in some ways, Goodfellas is an anomaly. It's a throwback.
Isn't it?
Right?
Yes. Wonderful.
So,
I thought so too.
Yeah. So what happens is, you know, Jaws happens.
Yeah.
And Star Wars happens.
Yeah.
Close Encounters happens.
Yes.
Movie going becomes the realm of spectacle,
mm-hmm,
right? And everybody's after these big hits that are, you know, when it just is amazing to me that less, I mean, you know, prior to Jaws, some of the highest grossing movies were challenging movies like The Godfather and The,
mm-hmm,
Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
So that all changed, right? It ended, historically, everybody likes to say, with Heaven's Gate, Michael Cimino.
Yeah, that
spending way too much money.
Yep.
Didn't earn anything, and they were like, done. We're done with art. Even at that time, Raging Bull had come out. and was, even though critical success, a commercial failure. And that starts Scorsese on this kind of, this path of really, you know, coming off of New York, New York, another big, you know, spent a lot of money on that to make a kind of throwback homage to 1940s musicals with Scorsese's sensibility of violence and brutality, and didn't go over well. So Scorsese, you know, works for the better part of a decade kind of under the radar. No one's paying attention. King of comedy, no one really, you know, De Niro continues to work with him, but
yeah,
audiences aren't paying attention. Then he gets a hold of this Goodfellas, and it is transformative. It is one of the most influential films I think ever made. This is the thing. I've seen Goodfellas so many times. I know all the beats, all the little moves. It used to bother me when I'd see people stealing from Scorsese, and I saw it everywhere. I mean, guys like who's the guy that the American Hustle, and you know what I'm talking about? American Hustle and The Fighter.
Yeah.
That guy's stealing from him all the time.
But
Paul Thomas Anderson used to steal from him.
But that's the greatest compliment of all, is that they are taking from him. They're so influenced by him and so influenced by this movie, which you're so right, is kind of a throwback in its way. And for me, it's that emphasis once again on capturing that family motif in there, and Scorsese bringing it from his youth, where he grew up on the streets, and you can feel it. And then a director who I think really loves actors, because although he dominates his films the way, say, Woody Allen might, you always say you know a Woody Allen film, and you might know a Scorsese film, but this guy can take actors like De Niro and shape them. I can see his influence in this film, holding De Niro back.
Right, which gives that character, Jimmy the Gent, such power, right? Because we know when De Niro teams up with Scorsese, we get lunacy. We get Travis Bickle. We get Jake LaMotta. We get Rupert Pupkin. So here he is. Yeah, you're right. He's deliberately kind of sitting on that character for another kind of power, for a different kind of power. Pesci obviously got everybody's attention.
Great example, yes.
As Tommy DeVito.
The other side.
The little guy. The little guy with the psychotic temper, right? And that became another. They were like yin and yang, those two.
And in the middle for me, Paul Sorvino.
Lording over everything.
Oh, I mean,
watching everybody. I can see the shot right now. They're in the backyard eating sausage and peppers, and he's just watching. Watching everyone.
Yes, I know. So underplayed. Beautifully. And I see a director's influence in that. Frequently you can't. But when you have great actors, I guess you have to have a great director who's able to guide them, let them go with their talents, but shape them for the film. And he does that.
I would say, you know, talking about the connection between these two movies, that Chinatown, you know, and this is something I was fascinated with that the book gets into a lot, is the title, what the title means.
Yes.
And Chinatown for Robert Town was a state of mind.
Oh, great.
You know, of regret, of failure, of, you know, something that you can't really quite put your finger on, but it's not a good state of mind. It's, you know, where it's a place where something, where best intentions go horribly wrong, maybe. And, you know, that becomes a wonderful stand-in for what Hollywood, that era of Hollywood is lost.
Yep.
You know, the creative, the power of the creative, the auteur is gone.
And what I love about that ending for Chinatown, the final line.
Yeah, forget it. Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
It's Chinatown. Right? It's just that kind of, you know, you got to let it alone. Mm-hmm. You got to let it be what it is. And and that's Polanski's influence on that.
Yeah.
So we're talking about great directors here in both cases. And in the case of Polanski, we're talking about somebody who says this is the way. Robert Town wants it to be a happy Hollywood ending.
Right.
Polanski won't have any part of it.
Right.
And his whole nature is toward the dark.
Yeah.
You know, so I can see his influence.
Yeah, and think about the ending. Okay, so Chinatown ends in Chinatown.
Yes.
With death and betrayal.
Yep.
And all this horrible stuff. Goodfellas ends with Henry Hill ratting out everybody.
Yeah, right.
Ratting out all of his friends and family, you know, and then being placed in witness protection.
Yes.
And the last shot of him is coming out of some suburban development house, picking up his newspaper and complaining about the marinara. And it's like ketchup, you know? And an interesting side note, I don't know if you caught this while you're researching any of this stuff, is that the book Goodfellas was based on Nicholas Pileggi's Wise Guy.
Right.
Or Wise Guys, rather. They changed the name of it because there was a show on TV at that time on CBS called Wise Guys.
Okay.
So they changed it to Goodfellas, which is a, you know, obviously it's just a synonym for gangsters. Mm-hmm. But Pileggi was an AP reporter, I guess, who was covering all the gangster stuff, mafia stuff in and around New York. He was dating Nora Ephron at the time, who wrote a screenplay based on the same material. That movie turned out to be My Blue Heaven with Steve Martin.
No, really?
You remember that?
No.
Steve Martin. And it's basically that story of Henry Hill being, you know, like a gangster being subsumed by suburban life.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, so then in both cases, in Goodfellas and Chinatown, we're talking about extraordinary films. And how could we, for our audience, encapsulate the reason that they're both great films? And you're really good at doing this. I mean, and we have devoted our show, our regular cinema classics, and this podcast to these two films.
You're going to ask me that with just 3 minutes left.
I am.
You know, I will say, because they are the confluence of everything great about movie making. Chinatown is a wonder of costume design, production design, editorial pacing, cinematography. The music is perfect. You remember that bit in the book about how they had to get just the right music. You know, Polanski's sensibility, his ability to know where to put the camera, how to tell this story, what to cut, what would the audience know? I mean, it's a miracle a great movie ever gets made. Goodfellas, the same thing. I think I think in a way it's different. I believe probably that Scorsese was probably left to his own devices a little bit more, which is weird at this point. You know, having had so many commercial failures, I'm not sure. I have to read this Glenn Kenny book. I'm not sure how he got, you know, the freedom to do what he did. Yeah. I've read stuff like, you know, that test audiences, large swaths of them, walked out of test screenings 30 seconds into the movie when they're stabbing Billy Batts in the trunk. You know, that's how that movie opens. But look at it, it's the same thing. It's about the story, style and service of the story, and in service of the themes of the story, right? They're two drastically, stylistically different movies. One is very staccato and in your face, like a snort of cocaine. You know, that shot of Ray Liotta's face as he does that line of cocaine. And the way Scorsese uses music, you know, they are about sort of decay, right? In some ways, both of them,
sure,
about regret and decay, and how you get sucked into something. So there are some similarities there, but you know, if Chinatown represents a sort of death and a longing for a time past. Mm-hmm. Goodfellas was this crazy sort of adrenaline rush, a shot in the arm, if you will, to Hollywood creativity. I mean, we might argue that we wouldn't have seen Tarantino flourish like he had as a voice without the success of Goodfellas.
Boy, you're right. The influences. You are so right. The influences are all over the place. You were making me think, I don't even know if it ties anything in for you, but about images, and the image in my mind as you were talking from Chinatown was actually Polanski having himself cut the nose of Jack Nicholson and putting the Band-Aid on it, and annoyingly keeping that Band-Aid through most of the film.
Yeah, through the middle half part of it.
What, you know, we're talking about directors and actors doing memorable things, and that's, to me, that is it.
Right. And you know what, that's what I'm talking about thinking, like directors who think through things, right? Yeah. So Chinatown is ostensibly about beautiful LA, that landscape, right? the landscape around it, but there's something horribly wrong.
Yes, there is.
Right? There's corruption.
They need water.
They need water, and they're hurting people to do it.
Yeah.
Right? Jake falls in love with the Faye Dunaway character.
Sure.
Right? There's something horribly wrong there that is revealed later. We are seeing Nicholson in this, and it finally, his first leading man role where he's allowed to dress the part, look handsome, hair slicked back, and then run.
Yes.
And then Polanski takes this thing, yes, this nose injury,
yes,
and mars the beauty of that for,
yes, yes,
for a little bit.
Yes.
He wants us to think constantly about what's underneath, right? What's going on that we're not seeing? Or don't look too lovingly at things that appear perfect.
Yes.
They're not. And that's sort of the lesson of Goodfellas too, right?
Yes.
I mean, Henry is enamored of this lifestyle, of the suits, the hair, the swagger, the way these guys walk, the way they drive up, the way they can walk through the back of, you know, the club and get a great table right up front. But there's darkness under there.
Well, and don't you think that currently the situation in California, if you take a look at just the fires,
mm-hmm,
that underneath that beauty is that darkness, the risks that you take in being in such environments, in both cases, in both films,
yeah,
there it is, that undercurrent that's so thrilling,
right,
in characters and story.
Mm-hmm. And just as a closing thought, you know, Wasson's book sort of, you know, explains to us in really evocative detail how that great period of Hollywood movie making came to an end, you know, when these TV morons took over. So it's a miracle. It really is a miracle that a movie and great movies continued to be made.
Yes.
In a system designed to keep them from being made. And so that Goodfellas ever saw the light of day in the form that Scorsese wanted it, that he crafted that, and that vision made it to the screen and connected with audiences, to me, that's really hopeful, you know? And unfortunately, it's 30 years.
What's the big film that Scorsese recently did for Netflix?
The Irishman.
Sure. So Scorsese is still working it,
yeah,
to his own advantage, and Polanski is still, even as an exile as he is,
right,
is still productive.
Yeah, yeah. We're just waiting for that. Aren't we just always, as movie lovers, as cinephiles, as critics, as people who just love movies, aren't we always waiting for the next Chinatown,
yes,
or Goodfellas?
Yes, yes.